Accession number 19866, Reel 1.
Is James Neesaw on the November 3, 1999, dictating inserts for the tape I dictated with Conrad Wood, which I foolishly forgot to put in at that time. There are several which I will do separately. The first one begins now. People sometimes ask how, in Burma, or at least in the Arakan, we spent each day. We could not be fighting, and we certainly weren't. But, though I was there for many months as a platoon commander, one only remembers with great clarity the few exciting or bizarre incidents of that time. Each of us had dug in our platoon position, which was on top of a hill, a weapon pit which we called, in those days, a foxhole. It was a slit trench about the size of a grave, which was the occasion of some macabre humor. And we slept, each in his own weapon pit. I don't think we had any blankets. It was very hot. We did have a rubber ground sheet and a strip of mosquito net, which we stretched over our wrists and faced as I get mosquitoes away. We were issued with tins, rather like boot polish tins, of some anti-mosquito ointment, but this stung very badly around the eyes, which is where the mosquitoes clustered most. Some other regiment, I remember, had issued everyone with complete mosquito nets, and on a patrol, the soldiers were under these nets, but the Japanese came upon them and bayoneted them as they lay. So we were rather more cautious and just had strips around the exposed flesh. And through the night, we were on guard duty. There was enough of us, unless we were on a patrol, to spread it out so that we didn't have to have every night disturbed. The guards would spend 2 hours on and then wake the next pair to take over for them. And so it went on from dusk until about an hour before reveille, or stand to, as I think it was called. Then we all got into position with our weapons ready in case there was a dawn attack. I never remember one being made, however. Breakfast was made by someone who had been a cook in civilian life. It was quite a simple meal. We had big ration tins, rather like made of sort of zinc-covered tin, in which rations have been delivered, and these are about 2 feet deep, about a foot across at the top, foot square. We put a wooden handle on the top, and the tea was boiled up in there, and then the soya links, which are made like long sausages made of soya, beans ground up, I think, in skins, and there was bread, margarine or butter from a tin, and usually tins of South African jam, or some sort of marmalade. The morning was taken up with checking and cleaning all the weapons. There was so much humidity and so much dust in these pits that every day the bolt action and the other actions had to be cleaned and oiled and wrapped up in a handkerchief or something to keep the dust from them. Lying in these pits during the night, and sometimes when we slept in the day off duty, there were kinds of insects and centipedes that had come out of the earth and stinging red ants. It was not very pleasant looking back, but at the time, it didn't seem all that unpleasant. We were in a group together. We had safety and comradeship, and we expected very little. We certainly got very little, but at least we were alive, and that was a great bonus. During the day, as platoon commander, I had to attend what was known as orders with the company commander, sometimes with the CO, the other platoon commanders, the intelligence officer, and we discussed what little was known about the Japanese intentions, what our intentions were. And then we were going on a patrol, as we did very frequently. We had to come back and tell the men who were coming on patrol with us exactly what was happening, when we were due to go. We seemed to leave, as far as I remember, in the late afternoon, and then hold up at night somewhere, and then went on the next day for as long as the patrol lasted. I remember once being sent out with a patrol to collect a member of Force 136. This was an intelligence group largely made up of people who had been resident in Burma, often on the timber, with the timber yards, and they bravely elected to stay behind, and they lived, as the Burmese did, in villages, and sent messages of the Japanese intentions, a very risky and often a very short life. On this occasion, I was detailed with a patrol to go and bring out such a man who had spent his time in the jungle and was due for leave. We marched on a compass bearing, but the compasses were very old. I remember the one I had was stamped 1929, and the needle would waver about from left to right. The sergeant, the platoon, he had a compass too, and both of these compasses read totally different readings for north. We therefore told the north, calculated the north by the sun, and a wristwatch, as far as I remember, one had to point the hour hand of the wristwatch towards the sun, and the north was some calculation from that, which now I forget. We went on for several days, and we had to carry our own rations. The longer we went, of course, the less rations we had to carry, so we were traveling more lightly. And finally, we reached a little village, just huts up on stilts with animals underneath, goats and so on. And as we reached one outside hut, a man climbed down the ladder. He was dressed in the Burmese lungi, L-O-N-G-G-Y-I, a sort of skirt, long skirt. And towards us, he said in perfect English, "Mr. Leesaw, I presume," quoting, or echoing, Stanley and Livingstone's greeting many years earlier. This man in the back of the hut had a curious contraption like a bicycle frame without any wheels. And he would sit on the saddle and pedal, and the chain was connected to a dynamo which would charge a battery so he could send his messages. It always amazed me the Japanese never discovered this, but the locals, though we'd abandoned them, he had not abandoned them, and they were extremely loyal to him, and we brought him out. On another occasion, I had to take a patrol through a village. This is rather a misnomer, just a mass of huts on stilts, and a track running down to a river in between them. And we had gone the other side of the village and were now coming back to our base, and it was dark, and we had to lie up for the night because it was quite impossible to march through the night. We couldn't read a compass. You get no means of discovering where the tracks were or where you were going. As we approached this village, it was pouring with rain in the monsoon. and dogs were barking, and some Burmese came out and introduced himself as the head man and said the Japanese were around the village and had been in there only recently. It wasn't safe for us to go on. Yet, how could we stay? He offered to give us shelter. It was only a section platoon, about seven men, in one of these huts. We climbed up the ladder. Chickens were squawking. Dogs barking and kicked into silence. We got on this top floor, and we were extremely uneasy. Was this a trap? Was it just a means of capturing us? Was he in league with the Japanese? I liked the look of the man. He must have liked the look of us, because we had to trust each other. I asked if he was a Muslim. He said he was. I said, had he been to Mecca or Medina, the holy places? He said he hadn't. He wished to go, because then he could dye his beard red. It was a mark of great respect for the others. I said, now we are in your hands, and yet in a sense you are in our hands. Because although we may be attacked by the Japanese, who could come underneath and fire up through the bamboo floor, we will fire down on them. And it'll be a mess altogether. But I can guarantee I can get you to Mecca for a pilgrimage if we come out of this alive. Can I trust you? He said. I said, I promise. We shook hands. And the Japanese came round the hut. We heard them talking and the Burmese answering. And we all crouched up there with our fingers on the safety catches of our guns. They went away, and the man had kept his word. Now I had to keep mine. And when I got back, I explained to the intelligence officer, the battalion, what had happened. And we made contact with this man, and he was put on some vehicle to get him to the coast, then to the got a safe passage to Chittagong, where the ships, like the El Medina, which had brought me from Calcutta, were taking pilgrims to the holy places, and I'm glad to say that we honored our bond there, as he had honored his bond to us. Some of these patrols, we were told that we sighted any troops whatever, we would open fire on them. It was not unknown for the Japanese to dress as locals. And the rumor was they'd also dressed some with bush hats and jackets from dead British troops, Indian troops. And so we viewed these orders with considerable regard. On a Saturday evening, we were coming back, and dusk was falling, as it does very quickly in the tropics. And clear, we couldn't get back to base before night. So we moved up a hillside to cover what we called a position of all-round defense and prepared to spend the night. Hardly were we in position when we saw the bottom of the hill. It was more probably only a few hundred feet high. We saw a group of men marching in single file with rifles. Now they had the look of British troops, but indistinct, we couldn't see them exactly. We couldn't call out to them. So, with another soldier, I went down to see them, and they told the rest behind to fire if they fired on us. Anyhow, we walked down the hill. As we got near, we shouted out rather absurdly, "Hello there, who's that?" And the platoon commander, just as young as I was, explained who he was, and also that his orders were to shoot these or any troops, just as ours had been. Luckily, neither of us fired. They spent the night with us on the hill, and next morning we all went our separate ways. End of that side, going over now. This is the second side of the tape for Gordon, for Conrad Wood, and the third episode, which I remember, begins now. I said that most of the days were pretty routine. One merged into another. People went on leave. Others had letters from home. Maybe someone had died. The married ones, too often their wives had got tired of waiting and had gone off with someone else. Looking back, this did not always seem to cause great anguish, or if it did, the recipients concealed it. But they had been away for months, possibly years, and home life was a totally different world. What did worry them, if there were any children, was who was looking after the children. Were they all right? And letters took a long time to be sent and to be received. We wrote on aircrafts, mostly, which were one size of about A3 paper. And there was a space at the top for the red dress. We handed these in to some post clerk. They were sent to some main depot and then photographed and diminished the size of a micro dot so that thousands of letters could go in a small space of one film spool. They were sent back by air and then in some postal depot in England they were developed and enlarged and sent to the recipients. The highlight of our time was going on leave, usually to Calcutta, or sometimes the more adventurous ones went to a leave centre in Darjeeling, up in the hills. One day, the battalion said that, the CO announced that there was a special task which volunteers required, and if carried out successfully, they would get a fortnight's leave. This was a remarkable chance to go away for 2 weeks. And I think many platoons put in for it. The task was to go across the paddy fields and through the passage of the jungle to a river. Once a week, a Japanese launch was said to come up this river bearing stores or ammunition or something. And the patrol had to shoot up this launch, sink it, and make their way back. Each week passed, and various people went out and tried their luck. And our town came along. And it struck me we would need as much firepower as he could. I was already carrying a Tommy gun, a Thompson submachine gun, with the magazines kept free aside, I think, in the ammunition pouches that we wore. Other had rifles. We exchanged these borrowed Tommy guns from others and carried a curious bane of the infantry, the boy's anti-tank rifle. This was presumably invented by a man called Boyes, I think, B-O-Y-E-S. It was a huge rifle which fired a 4-5 or even larger caliber bullet. And the thing was so badly designed that its kick was so great it had a reputation of dislocating the shoulder of anyone who was firing it. For this reason, the more cautious firers of the boy's anti-tank rifle would put the butt against a tree that would shake when the thing was fired. It would be quite useless against any tank. It might scratch the paint, but that was all. But it was the biggest weapon we had, so we took it with us on this task. We set off at dusk, crossed the paddy fields, through the clumps of trees, found the river, and took up our positions. The river was wide, so we moved down to one side where there was some kind of impediment in the street. I think it was the thing like a pier on the other side with a small building, so that the boat would have to come out towards us, which would give us a better chance of hitting it and a more accurate chance of hitting it. We took up our positions. We lay not speaking, just under our breath, cursing the mosquitoes and the ants and insects that beat us. Then, in the distance, we heard the putt, putt, putt of a heavy old engine. And sure enough, round a bend came this wooden motor launch. It had a half cabin. We could see no one aboard it, so they're obviously in the cabin or in the back cockpit. It came up slowly with a bow wave and a wash behind it. As it drew level, we opened fire with everything. And we all hit the boat. We had a tremendous firepower went into it. But nothing happened. It just sailed on. Either we should have aimed under the waterline, or the boat, which I think probably was the case, was armoured inside the ordinary wooden sides of the hull. It sailed on serenely. No, we had to get back. As we'd moved down the river, we found that there were Japanese already in position behind us, the river on one side, the Japanese on the other. There had been no Japanese, of course, when we first took up, when we first arrived in the riverbank, but presumably they must have suspected that it might be an attack on this one dangerous part of the river. And they were all in slit trenches, foxholes just like ours. They were asleep. And I remember we ran back, literally jumping over Japanese who were tearing up in the foxholes. They were under our feet. We didn't stop to shoot, and they didn't shoot us. We just ran and got back, but unfortunately had no leave. On another occasion, we were packed into 1500 weight trucks and taken after dark along a track in convoy without lights for several hours. When we got out of the trucks, we then had to march very sleepily till about 3 a.m. and we came to two round hills which could be seen in the early light in silhouette. At the bottom of these, the nearest hill, several tanks were drawn up. And we were told in whispers we had to attack this hill. The tanks would open fire and fire ahead of us to deal with Japanese and defend us, who of course would be in their foxholes. We would know where the tanks were firing because they would have a very V-E-R-E-Y coloured shell every so often. And where that landed, we wouldn't have to rush too soon or we would get in under our own fire. Equally, we couldn't lag behind. All the fire would be useless. So we got in position. The tank engine start up with a tremendous noise. And we got the hill. Well, I remember those rifles with fixed bayonets went in a long line, met a sort of trot. I remember when you attack like this, it's funny how you try to hunch your body up as though you give yourself the smallest possible target to any enemy. But we loped up the hill, up to the top, collapsed to the ground in a circle, facing outwards, the classic position of all-round defense. Nothing, there was no one there, no sign of anybody. We were exhausted from the climb up the hill after the long drive in the trucks, no sleep, and the nervous reaction, as we'd expected to have a very hostile reception. And the radio operator came, crawled over to me and said, they're on the phone. HQ, I said, what do they want? They say we're to go down and then attack the hill next. next door. They've made a mistake. The Japs are there, not here. Have you answered it? I said, acknowledged it. He said, no. Well, I said, don't. Switch it off. So we waited at dawn and then came down the hill. No one ever asked about the message. And as far as we could see, there was no sign of any life on the other hill. It was back along the track, then into the trucks, and late on a hot morning, we reached our base. A rather wasted night, but at least no casualties. I had, the war was over, when I was on the Prome to Pegu road that went from Rangoon in the south through those two little towns up to the north and then on to Mandalay, branch to Mamio into the hills, M-A-Y-M-Y-O. I was an Indian Army observer then, and I'd got a berth with 17 Indian Division, and was living in some sort of hut at the side of the road. The road, as I remember, was built up to keep it out of the rains and the monsoon. It was built up to a height of perhaps 10, 15 feet. And lying in my hut, when some other officer came in, officer I was awake, said, yes, I was. He'd been heard on the radio, the war was over, some great bomb had been dropped over Japan. The emperor wanted peace. But did the Japanese here know this? This was the great question. We were due to go to a place called War, W-A-W, on the Rangoon Road, farther south. And this was a railway branch line which had crossed the Sitang River to Moulmein, farther south. And there was a railway bridge across here, but this had most unfortunately been blown by the retreating British in 1942, before all the British troops were over, so a number were left on the wrong side of the river. Some tried to swim, but the river was in full spate at that time, the early part of the monsoon, and only a few got away. We crossed in barges, landing barges, I suppose, and to the other side. And as far as I remember, we just sat and waited. And then we saw a water buffalo coming to us. It seemed to be moving at a fair trot, which is unlike one of those lethargic beasts. So it had been given a push. It must have been pushed by the Japanese as it was coming from their direction. As it grew near, we saw that there was a piece of cardboard tied to its tail. And on this was written in English in capital letters, "Is war over?" The Japanese had also heard the rumor. They wanted to make sure. But it was over. And now we all had to prepare for going home. Although many of us had been out there for a long time, not all viewed the prospect of civilian life with unalloyed pleasure. When you've had decisions made for you, food provided, money paid into a bank, though the conditions were dangerous and rough, there was security of a kind. And especially men had been in their early 20s and called up, and were now getting on for 30. How would they face, how would they react? Well, that was something we all had to face, decide in our own way. The war, at last, was over. The exigencies of the service, as the phrase said in our books about details of service, decreed, but hostilities were at an end. I hope these items can be fitted in the appropriate place if you think they're worth it, Conrad. It's a long time ago now, one's memory. Maybe at fault in some small matters of recollection, but not, I think, on the large ones. They made an indelible impression on everyone who was there. Thanks for your patience. Looking forward to see you again one day. Cheerio.